Velkommen til Hesteveterinærene, en podcast fra Børing Ringelheim Animal Health. I denne podden snakker vi med spesialister fra forskjellige områder innen hest og veterinærmedisin, som deler den samme brennende interesse for hest som deg og meg. Hei og velkommen til Hesteveterinærene, podden for deg som veterinær eller dyrepleier og som jobber med hest. I den fjerde og siste episoden om temaet hesteeierkommunikasjon snakker mine kolleger Maria og Louise med både Tamsin Furtado og Rebecca Smith om hvordan man tar den vanskelige samtalen. Når prognosen er dårlig eller hesten skal avlives.
Welcome back to the fourth episode with Tamsin and Rebecca from Liverpool University, where we're talking about owner compliance and talking to owners and how we as veterinary professionals can communicate with owners. In this episode, I've also invited my colleague Louise, who is a technical manager here at Boehringer Ingelheim with me, but you are also a very experienced internal medicine vet, Louise. Please tell us a little bit about you.
Yes, hi Maria. Thank you very much for this introduction. I'm a veterinarian, graduated from 2004, and I've always known that I wanted to be a veterinarian. And I've always had a very keen interest in the internal medicine aspect, and I pursued a speciality degree in internal medicine with large animals and finished that one in the United States in 2014. And so I did some research myself in gastric ulcers, and so I've been very interested in all these lifestyle diseases of horses for a very long time. And I've practiced for the past 10, 15 years doing specialty veterinary work in internal medicine in private practices for the past many, many years. So I've had a lot of these difficult conversations with owners, so that's why I'm here today.
Yes, we're very happy for that. Yeah, and so we're going to be talking about the difficult subjects. And it's, talking to owners and having success in and a successful outcome is always very rewarding, and happy owners and happy vets and so on. But when things aren't going that well, we also need to be able to communicate around those things. So I'm going to ask then Tamsin and Rebecca, what's different about these types of discussions when it comes to poor prognosis, for example?
Everything everything is different about these. I think it's so tricky, both from a research perspective, but also as a horse owner. These types of discussions are so different because very often, of course not always, but very often they involve really heightened emotions. And I think for vets, of course, you might have these, like Louise is obviously incredibly experienced and has probably had hundreds of those conversations. If you're on the receiving end of them, you might only have that one experience of colic surgery decisions or one experience of having to decide whether to put a horse down. So if you view the horse as a companion, for example, have a close relationship with them, or another situation, even if they are kind of a working animal to you, but you have a particularly maybe close connection with them, then often when that type of very severe poor prognosis or difficult surgery decision or euthanasia has to be discussed, then essentially what happens is that your brain goes into a panic mode. So your brain feels like you're under attack. And at that point, we know, just like with our animals, when they go over threshold, we know that we're not taking on information fully, because we can't comprehend, we can't learn things in that state. So it's a really tricky time to give people a lot of information. So things like poor prognosis, of course, there's probably things we need to know. You know, we need to make weigh up different decisions about, I don't know, what surgery the horse might need, or what medications they might need, or cost. And those are the complex decisions which we would want to make in a kind of inverted commas rational state of mind, but we don't have a rational state of mind. So we're only able to take on maybe the, I think in human medicine, they've shown maybe 10 or 20% of the actual consult. And this is where you mentioned earlier, Maria, about, I thought it was so interesting what you said about needing to, the vet nurse role sometimes feeling like being a translator between the vet and the owner when, you know, the vet's gone and the owner, we've all been there ourselves, right, in different situations with a professional where they tell you things and you take on board, obviously, as much as you can at the time. But then it's when you start thinking about the realities that you have questions. So I think remembering the extent of the emotional ties can be really important there. What do you think, Becky?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I guess I was just going to add, I suppose, onto that is, if we think about poor prognosis, we also need to think about, I guess we might have an idea, even though we might not be clear about time scales or anything like that in for that horse, but actually as a vet and based on varying, you know, years of experience, we might have an idea about what that means and what that means for the future, but we don't really know. Potentially the owner may not have even called you out for something that you've then identified. We don't know what stage they're at in potentially even thinking that there was anything really wrong with their animal, you know, let alone what this might mean for them and what they have, you know, what they might, decisions they might have to make. So I guess that links back to, you know, yeah, trying to figure out what that owner is thinking, where they're at and what they might need from you. And I guess when we think about euthanasia as well, I guess for vets, although decisions are never easy, we may, you know, see that euthanasia is relieving suffering and that's, you know, a good thing to do if we feel that that animal's welfare is bad. But that might be kind of like Tamsin saying, this might be the first time an owner's even had to think about that. And they may have different ideas around, you know, euthanasia and making those decisions that might be quite different from how we might see that and what the right thing to do might be.
Mm. What's your experience, Louise, in these conversations? As we said, you've had them lots of times. What's the most difficult thing with it?
I think the most difficult thing is to make sure that you meet the individual owner with the communication that they can understand. So reading the owner across from you and how they like to have the communication. Some people are extremely blunt and they just need it straight on. And others, you really, really have to be careful because one wrong word will make them completely block out everything else that you say. And I think this is something that you can only gain by experience. You know, the way to read people across from you when you've had enough of these experiences, it does become easier to read people and how to reach people at their level. And as Tamsin said, to have really respect for, no matter who you're standing across, there is a limited amount of information that people can understand. So you have to be very, very clear in your communication. So sometimes what I've done, if people are very distraught, is to kind of, in my mind, have three options that kind of I can present to them. And I will say from the beginning, now I'll present three options for you so they know what to expect, and then be very clear in those three options and make it short with the three options. And that way they can ask themselves to figure out what is the best option for them. So to keep the communication in such a difficult situation as simple as possible is sometimes the way to go. And then the conversation can start from then on, that they have these three options and then go from there. So very clear and easy communication is key.
Yeah, I was just going to follow up, I guess, on that point and say, I guess we kind of think about shared decision making and making these decisions with owners, but you maybe think actually that what owners want from us differs as well, and some do want to be guided more than others, and I think that can be difficult maybe for vets as well to tread that line. So I didn't know if you had any thoughts on that, or how you developed an approach to those kinds of situations, Louise.
I think it's a lot to do with, if you have a difficult conversation with an owner that you've never met, it's always harder because you have to read the body language when you present the opportunities for them. You have to be very sharp on reading their body language into where do they really need to go or where do they want to go. And you have to read that between the lines. If you've had a very established relationship with a horse that's been sick for a long time and you've tried and you've gone down the road and you know where it's going to end up, you will have that information already given to you that they essentially just needs to be supported in their final decision. And I think supporting the owners in their decision, unless it's completely ridiculous that they want to euthanize for something very minor and they've completely misunderstood the gravity of things, but giving them the support when you feel that they essentially have made up their mind, they just need the support from their vet. The support is extremely important. Yeah. So reading body languages is, if you're good at that, you will get far in this business.
Is there any sort of science around this, different personality types or different ways to approach different personalities?
Yeah, that's such a tricky one. There's been loads of research, particularly in business management fields and in psychology, around different personality types. And I'm sure we're all familiar with Myers-Briggs and also the type A, B, C, and D personalities, where type A is the one people usually know, especially vets, usually they're like really driven people who, always getting up early to get everything done and so on. But what I don't think we have is an understanding of there being a clear delineation that, type A people like to be spoken to like this, and, type D people like this, or, introverts do this. And I think that's probably because people are just so complex. And also, when we're in a situation like we're talking about with these difficult conversations, we're in that emotional state of mind. So even the normal rules might not apply. You might be someone who really likes cut and dried conversations, but in this situation, you just need a bit more, some gentle support, or vice versa. I was just reflecting on a situation as a researcher who studies this stuff. Of course, it's really interesting every time I have a vet to kind of come to my horses and think about their how I feel, their language and the support I get. And I had to have a horse put to sleep a couple of years back with a broken pedal bone, and he also had we'd already been through a rehabilitation for kissing spines and suspensory desmitis, so he was quite a bit of a car crash horse, bless him. And it was interesting thinking through, so I although normally I think I would like the kind of fluffier language, in that case I just did want the cut and dried, what's the best thing to do here in your experience. And I think kind of going back to what Louise said, I think of course it's so hard, and none of us could ever expect vets to get it right every time. Absolutely, that's a really huge ask when you're also trying to manage a complex situation. You've got an animal in pain there as well. And again, I would just say asking people can be really helpful. Are you a person, do you want detail? Do you want numbers here? Would you prefer at the moment that I simplify it for you and then we come back later, or you speak with someone else later? And perhaps checking in where they're going to go for backup advice when they do have questions, I think is really key, because they definitely will, as we've said, have want to know more. And it may be that they have another friend who's a vet who they're going to ask, or it might be that, they're going to go to online forums, which can be, as we said, really helpful, but in other cases aren't. So I think just being aware that there are going to be other sources of advice can be really helpful, and making sure that they've got one that you both agree is going to be a kind of trusted resource can help there too.
Mm. But also then in this situation, ask right up front, how would you like me to deliver this information? It seems pretty straightforward, but it can also be quite difficult, but it maybe it will make things easier
for you?
Yeah, I think, of course, again, that's going to depend on the situation and on the person, and also on you, on your own, you know, every vet and every medic is going to have their own communication style that they've honed over years, and that's part of who you are, and that's absolutely fine, and a good thing, in fact. But yeah, if in some cases, then I certainly think there would be merit in saying, you know, there's a lot to take in here. Would you like me to give you the, you know, the kind of bare bones three options now, and then more detail later on, or would you like the would you like the depth now, and you know, we can come back to it, or kind of asking them how they want that information presented.
No, I think that's very, very key, and also having to, like you say, ask them, but also make sure that they if they have somebody that they would like to be present for these conversations, if it is at all possible, make sure you have two people there. One as a support and the other one that's kind of making the decisions, because having two people that can kind of support each other is by far much better than just having one person that might be devastated at the time. So having a second support person would be definitely valuable.
I was just going to add, I had a couple of examples in my data, but just that people's minds can change, I suppose. So there was just one example of a vet that had been working with an owner who owned like a riding establishment. So she used these ponies, you know, within her riding school. And they'd worked together for a number of years, and one of the ponies had had a chronic eye problem. So they'd come to the decision that actually, well, the vet said to me, they'd, you know, after discussions, they decided that no, they would put this horse to sleep. They didn't want to pay for to remove the eye. But actually, when they went back to do that, the owner had actually changed her mind, and they performed the enucleation, and the pony did really well, and they were very pleased. So I guess just, we're talking about lots of different contexts, I suppose, and you've got to think about that animal's welfare or as to whether that would be an appropriate approach. But just that actually people, if we're thinking about the emotions and the reasons people might have that people might change their mind, and I guess being adaptable and then finding out where they're at that point in time is really important too.
Mm. Yeah, and I guess it depends a lot on as you say, on the situation and whether it's an emergency or not, because something can be really critical and really really poor prognosis, but it's not going to happen today and it's not going to happen tomorrow, and the horse won't suffer if we don't do anything right now. And I guess then you have a pretty different situation to as a horse has acute colic and it needs to be either on the surgery table or put down immediately. Those are two very different situations, I guess.
Yeah, it is very difficult when you're in the acute emergency situation, but I think you have to still let people have a little bit of time. If you, as your veterinarian, start rushing things, and things can be very dramatic around you, but I think you have to put yourself in the bubble with the owner to have a solid conversation regardless of what happens. Somebody else needs to take care of the horse in the meantime, but if you don't have that and spend time on that difficult conversation with the owner, then you can do everything correct, but the only thing that the owner will remember after either you euthanize or you take the horse to surgery will be that rushed conversation where they feel that they were not heard. So calming down and making sure that you're the solid rock in the room and ignoring the drama around you will make for a much better situation for the decision making, for the horse itself, for the aftermath of the situation. Because you have to remember that no matter what happens in the acute situation, there will be an afterthought. And that's where you really will have your value. If the aftermath of that whole situation will be that the owner remembers as a good and fair experience, then the whole thing will not be as traumatic as if they have the feeling that they were rushed into decision. Even though that they needed to be rushed a little bit, you have to be the rock that they trust for that conversation to go well.
I absolutely love that analogy of being the rock. That's such a lovely way of putting it. And
thank you.
That's, yeah, that perfectly sums up exactly what you need when you're in that situation, doesn't it? I think that idea of being the rock, well, yeah. I guess for the yeah. staff, for the horses and the and the client as well.
Yeah,
absolutely. Louise, how do you deal with the common question that people ask about what would you do if it was your horse?
Yeah, that's a classic, right?
Mm. It is a classic, and we're always told that not to answer that question, because then you know, you put yourself in the situation. Sometimes you cannot avoid it. You can keep saying that this is not my horse, but I will back up and I'll present them the options as well and again, and then keep saying that there is one of these choices that are right for you. That choice might not be what's right for me, but you know which one is correct for you. And then if you as the vet are very good at reading body languages, then you can see which one is by communication, word, nonverbal. You can sense which one. And then your job is to support that decision that the owner kind of shows you. But you have to kind of distance yourself a little bit from it. And tell them that those options, again, one of them will be right for you. You just have to, be supported in that decision.
Interesting. I always think that's such a difficult one. And again, I don't think there's a right or wrong. I can see the argument for not answering it, of course. But equally, I know that on the receiving end of it, that's what you want to know, is someone tell me what to do.
Yes.
Yeah, yes, really so, tough.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It is tricky. But there are so many things involved in that decision. There's emotional, that's the actual disease that we're handling. There's the owner's finances. And sometimes those things can be very different from person to person. And that's why you cannot say what would be right for you, because the things that I would put into that equation might be completely different. And if I say this is the right path for me, then deep down the owner will sit there and say, ooh, I'm not sure that's right for me. And then it's actually the other thing that's right for them. So... yeah, you have to try and avoid it, I guess.
Yeah, it's difficult discussions to have in any case, I guess. This question is both to you, Tamsin, and Rebecca. Are there any practical things that one can do if a vet feels like I should really become better at this? I really want to practice my difficult talk. How does one go about? Is there anything, a book that you could recommend, or, you know, something that you could do?
Yeah, really good question. I mean, yes, I would say, I mean, obviously talking with your colleagues again is really key, because then you can hear how other people, just phrases other people say, the concept, like Louise just saying, that thing of a rock, like that's one of the, I can tell already, that's one of those things that's going to stick in my mind, and it would be useful if I had to go out tomorrow and do this, you know. So sometimes things people say really kind of stick and are really helpful. I would, in terms of resources, I absolutely love the resources that is called motivational interviewing. And what these are is a style of having conversations which comes from human health, where people need to have a lifestyle change. But I can't kind of explain it in brief here, but basically what they do is to use active listening to pick up phrases and what people are saying to work out kind of what they want, and to help them kind of reflect back and work out what they want. So what we'll do, I can send over some examples of those. There are some really nice YouTube videos of people having a conversation with motivational interviewing, and basically what that might look like is talking with the client and asking them, what are your views on, in this case, let's say, can you tell me how your horse is looking now to you, in comparison to normal, or I don't know, asking about quality of life, for example, and then using kind of active listening and reflecting back to them, just sometimes reflecting back what they're saying, or picking up on specific things that they've said to kind of work out what's important to them. And that can be really powerful and very pragmatic, and also doesn't it sounds like it's something that takes ages, but it's not. It's just something we can kind of all learn from in our discussions. So I would absolutely recommend looking up motivational interviewing, and I'll send over some resources to, that can go in the notes for the podcast if people are interested.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that would be fantastic. And then we can put them there, and anyone interested could just click those links and go ahead and read more about it. That's very practical.
Yes, I was going to say motivational interviewing, but definitely a good approach. I guess what I would probably add to that is another resource that we can give you the link for, a book called Navigating Tough Cases. And that I found that very useful. I guess I've become more interested in animal ethics, veterinary ethics, and that's a really accessible book for people in practice, and it discusses some ethical theories which might help us to think about different perspectives around an issue, whether that's thinking about the different stakeholders that are involved, or different theories that might enable us to understand people's relationships differently and how they might come to a different view on what's right for that animal compared to us. But there's lots of like different examples, including the ones such as what would you do if someone asked you, what would you do if it was your animal. So I quite like that. So that's another good resource, I think, and for me it kind of just adds another layer of understanding, thinking about the complexity of these topics. So definitely, like, the motivational interviewing is a really practical approach, and this, I guess, gives you a bit of that theory and maybe adds to like what you're conscious of when you're trying to listen to what the owner's telling you and where their point of view might be coming from, and how you as a vet then navigate that within your professional role as well and your duties to that animal and the owner.
Good tips. I think it's always nice to have a sort of a resource or a book or something like that you can actually have in your hands to become better at these things, because they are difficult. I wanted to ask you also, what about when your opinion as a vet differs from the horse owner's? When you think that this horse should definitely have... this should definitely go one way, and the owner is completely at the opposite. I mean, we do have a welfare aspect here, animal welfare, and we are in many cases, veterinary professionals also are the animal sort of advocates, interpreting what they're trying to say, or be their sort of spokesperson. So how do we go about when we have very different opinions from what the owner says or thinks?
It's very difficult. And I guess through my research as well, I've started to think about, you know, the wider implications as well of these interactions that we have, which obviously the animal in front of us is the one that we're treating there. But the way that is handled... also has big implications for how that owner might involve you in the future with that animal or another animal. So it's really complicated, you know, I think. And I guess just, these resources that we've talked about are useful in, you know, trying to understand where someone is at and not just seeing the issue from your point of view as a vet, that our relationship with that animal is very different, and it's going to be largely based on our medical training as well as other experiences. Maybe we have horses or what, that's all going to shape what we're doing. And I think just trying to reflect on where each vet, you know, where you're coming from as much as where the owner might be coming from, to try and find a way forward is really crucial.
Well, I mean, if only there was a simple answer for how to, you know, how to navigate in every case. I don't think there can be, but there were some really interesting ones presented by vets in relation to obesity, of discussions of this sort, where, let's say, a horse had been an owner had had a horse who was very obese and ended up being euthanized due to serious laminitis. And then the owner had got another horse who was also was then obese and was very laminitic. And whether, you know, at what point, you know, how you intervene in that case. And of course, that could also involve, you know, should the horse be put to sleep or whatever. And I think it's so hard, isn't it? Absolute respect to vets who are having to kind of navigate these things, often under really difficult situations themselves and a lot of pressures, of course, really tough. So I think, I guess, making sure that you've got the support that you need to navigate that, whether that's colleagues or helplines or whatever. But I guess one of the practical things that came up a few times was people talking about trying different vets to having the discussion, and or having Louise mentioned about having two people present for a discussion. But we had a couple of cases where people talked about making sure that like a yard manager was there, or the person's best friend, or, you know, who are other people who may well be good at communicating with that person, perhaps because they have an existing relationship. I don't know about in your countries, but here the farrier is a really interesting one, because farriers often have quite a good relationship with owners over many years, but vets aren't always great at working alongside farriers, which is a real shame, because you've got the farrier there who's, you know, often can kind of advocate for the horse, watch, you know, they're there every time and can obviously, absolutely, depending on the individual, the client and the farrier, can sometimes be a really nice kind of in between to help you have that discussion if the case works in a way that, you know, you can do that, obviously. So yeah, I would say thinking about alternative forms of support that mean that, you know, maybe different communication styles, someone will get through slightly differently to you, or is there support who will be able to kind of help and remind the person of things you said afterwards, can be useful. Louise, you've must have done this a lot of times.
Yeah. I mean, if you're in a situation where it's kind of life and death, in our countries at least, we do have an obligation to be the animal's advocate, and we can request euthanasia if it's a situation where it's really life and death, that the decision needs to be made. And in those situations, then of course I say that I will be the responsible for this, and I take the decision away from the owner, because then it's a matter of the horse is dying anyways if nothing is done. So I take the support, I take the responsibility on my shoulders as a vet. But I usually have a lot of I usually tell the owner that I encourage them to get second opinions. So I ask them that if they want, if they still have questions and I can feel that the conversation might be going on and on and on, I really encourage them. I am the one that suggests second opinion, and that's very important. If they are the ones starting to come up with that aspect of maybe we should seek a second opinion, it's different. It's very different than I being the vet telling them about the option of a second opinion. In human medicine, they do that quite a lot to encourage people to seek second opinions. Of course, then I do tell them that make sure you choose a second opinion that's at a specialist level. If that's where we are in a very complicated disease process or something like that, make sure you seek second opinion that have some kind of a good solid background, so the opinion does become valid. But it needs to be somebody that they trust. And in many, many of those cases, people go back. And then they approach me again without having the second opinion searched, because I simply was the one suggesting it in the first place. Then somehow that trust came back on me 100% again. But never be afraid of telling owners to seek second opinions. If you know that you have made the right decision, you've guided them correctly, then second opinion should not be something that we should not have in our toolbox. Or even you telling them that you will seek a second opinion if you have doubts, but you have to make sure whether you're in doubt or not when you tell them about seeking second opinions. So that's the way that I do it.
That's very practical, I think.
I'm proactive in that sense, and I think that's key. Yeah,
I love that. I think going back to, I think Becky was talking a bit about trust as well between the vet and the client, and that's such a lovely example of how you can make sure that you're you're trusted because you're you know, allowing them, not that it's allowing, obviously, you know, they can do what they want, but you know, that you trust your own opinion enough, but also that you think it's a good idea that they can go out there and do that. I think that's really nice. I would say as well, I don't know about you, Becky, but I haven't had one single example in my data of a client disliking it when a vet has said, oh, I'm going to get a second opinion myself on this. Like, they seem to really actually most of the time are quite proud that their case is kind of warrants the vet needing to go and get more advice from someone else, and kind of actually really value that. So I know that vets sometimes feel like that's kind of sounds like they're giving up or they don't know the answer, but actually as far as I've well, certainly in my data, people have really appreciated that and actually liked it. Have you seen that as
I'm
well?
Not sure I've had any specific examples of that. But I guess just from my experiences, I guess as a younger vet as well, well, you might have mixed feelings about, you know, saying, oh, I need to get, or I want to get a second opinion or discuss that with a colleague. But I guess, you know, throughout the career, you could discuss with colleagues, and that's a good thing because you can learn from one another and get a different view and reflect on your own practice. So, yeah, I think it's something, you know, really that could be very useful for the vet and the client in that case.
So we all know that vets and veterinary professionals are under a lot of pressure. We have reports from various countries around the world that the veterinarians are experiencing depressions and stress and emotional stress in many different cases and in various situations. This, of course, I mean, these difficult talks and difficult situations, they will also bring another layer of sort of pressure on the vet. How do we manage that on a larger scale when we're talking about like the veterinary community or the veterinary industry as a whole? How can we manage this?
Well, perhaps I can answer as a non-vet who spends a lot of time talking to vets as an outsider, and then be interesting to hear from you guys about your experience. So as an outsider, I think it's quite interesting to sometimes you can kind of see, I don't know, you sort of see things a bit differently to because I haven't been through vet school and been kind of, I guess, shaped in that way. And I think it's quite, the vet industry is certainly set up in a way that is quite stressful. There's just so much pressure and on, like, emotionally, in terms of time, in terms of stress, but also in terms of the expectations of what vets will be able to do. So we know human behavior change takes a long time, but vets are supposed to be able to just get someone to just change their behavior in a, you know, 15-minute consult, or you know, they're given, right, you've got to go out and do 10 vaccines today, and in those vaccines you've also got to create a good rapport with the owner, even though you've got no time to do that, you just got to stab and go, as it were. And so I think that the pressures on vets are absolutely huge, and it's no wonder that those frustrations come through, especially with times when, like with obesity and laminitis, where you can see that the animal is in pain, and then that's going to be even more heightened in a situation with a poor prognosis or euthanasia or whatever. So, I mean, I think a really obvious one is more time for consults, but that's it sort of doesn't get to the heart of the problem. But I think these short consults are problematic. But also, you know, we spoke in the very first one about the role of vet nurses, and that there's a lot more, I think there's a lot more support that could be available for vets with those more difficult things than is used, certainly in the UK. So vet nurses, but also using other professionals to kind of support farriers, physios, for example, who might have an ongoing relationship with the client that you might not. Also in some countries, there's this new role of the veterinary social worker who is particularly skilled at having euthanasia discussions, for example. So this is becoming common in the US. So it might be, you know, might be a euthanasia discussion, but might also be like a aging animal discussion, or, you know, something like hoarding, where you've got really serious, you know, your average vet is not going to be equipped to have a discussion with someone who's an animal hoarder, because that's a, you know, complex mental health issue. So, but these would be people who are skilled in those discussions and can work alongside the vet. So I think, of course, these are structural changes that are going to take a long time to come in. It's not like any one practice can change tomorrow to doing that. But I do think that there are, this needs thinking about on a broader level than just, you know, vets should change and then then people will keep their horses better. You know, it is a bigger problem than that, I think. What do you guys think?
Well, I was just going to say, I think you've covered loads of topics there, which are really important. I guess I was just going to add that I think it's good that different disciplines are starting to become involved in or research and look at the veterinary profession, and kind of giving us a lens through which to actually think about what, you know, the things that we're experiencing in practice and the ways that we might be able to do that differently, or all the things that Tamsin's talked about there. But I think for me, that's really, you know, going through vet school in practice, but then getting trained in qualitative research and social science methods just opened up a whole new world for me to really see my own experiences in a different way. And I think that's really exciting. It might be highlighting things that are difficult, but that we're experiencing anyway. So, but hopefully in the long run, that can provide opportunities to, like all the things Tamsin's talked about there, that might be able to improve, you know, everyone's lives, really.
Yeah, I would say that education of the younger vets to maybe make some support groups, because initially, as younger vets, having to make all the decisions with the owner, it's a burden for younger vets that the only way to gain a lot of this experience is aging, right? So sometimes you can't force it, and having some support groups where people get a chance to talk about how to communicate tips and tricks amongst peers would probably be a good idea if the practice can set up these things, or even the industry somehow set up these things for exchange of experiences would be a good thing. And also, as we talked about, the famous question, what would you do? That's one of the things to try and avoid that, to answer that question, because you take the responsibility on your own. And if things don't go well afterwards, then your sense of responsibility might be too much to carry for some people. And it's so important to learn that those decisions are not meant to be yours. You have to present those options and choices to the owner and assist them in the decision making, but you should not take them upon yourself, because some vets, especially younger vets, will have a hard time carrying the burden of all those difficult decisions. So support network is key, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think there's been a lot of, focus on the clinical aspects, which is very important, but having opportunities for discussions about other parts of what we do is really essential as well. So yeah, just echo that.
Before we end this very nice conversation that I for sure could keep having for hours and hours, what would be your main take-home messages for vets listening out there when it comes to everything we've been talking about, communicating with owners on different topics, on difficult topics, easier topics? Your most important take-home messages.
Well, I was actually just going to say, I think the resources that maybe we talked about that we could provide would be a really good next step. And there's loads of resources and literature out there that could, you know, help vets to think about what they do in a different way, or just give them some different understanding or practical ways of approaching issues that they might be facing. So we can definitely pass them on.
I guess I would say no one is ever going to be perfect all the time, and I'm sure that there is some for every single vet out there, and this is actually all of us in our personal lives as well. There'll be times when we communicate really well, and there'll be times when we are not feeling our best maybe, and are a bit abrupt, or don't get through, or just don't connect with someone. And I think actually just even kind of bringing awareness to that and thinking about it, and why did that conversation go well, or why did that conversation go badly, and then talking about it with colleagues, I think is really key, because certainly we see that when people talk about these things and share their experiences, then everybody kind of learns a lot from that. So that would be my main take home, I guess, would be just kind of put your awareness on the communication and see what you can learn from yourself and your colleagues as well, because we can all improve all the time, I guess.
And I am sure that everyone who has been listening to these episodes have learned a lot. And I really want to thank you, Becky and Tamsin, for taking your time talking to us about these super important subjects. And also thanks, Louise, for your valuable input. It's always great to have the practical perspective. And the three of you had made a very good panel in this last discussion. So thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tusen takk for at du lytter til Hesteveterinærene. Hvis du liker det du hører, glem ikke å trykke følger eller lignende i podcast-appen din, slik at du ikke går glipp av en eneste episode. Fortell også gjerne om hva du syns ved å gi en tilbakemelding. Vi tar også gjerne imot tips om kommende gjester og emner. Kontaktinformasjonen vår finner du i beskrivelsen av podden. Vi høres snart!